Well, today is the third week of our series called The Final Day, where we're walking through the events of Jesus' last day on earth. And we began this final day journey a couple weeks ago, and we began just after sundown on what we now call Maundy Thursday. And if you'll remember, the disciples gathered together in an upper room just after dark, and they gathered to celebrate the Passover. It was a Passover meal. As Pastor Laura Allen shared with you that week, the Passover was a celebration meal remembering God's deliverance, God's salvation of the Israelite people from slavery to the Egyptians back in the book of Exodus. And so every year the Israelites would gather together, they'd have this Passover meal, and they would remember what God had done for them. And on this particular night, in this particular meal, Jesus gathered with his disciples and they celebrated the Passover, but also what happened was Jesus gave the disciples a new meaning for this Passover meal. In a sense, and essentially he was saying, now listen, I'm going to become this Passover. I'm going to become the Paschal Lamb that will deliver the whole world from slavery to sin and death. And so that's what happened on that first week of the series, of this final day. And after that meal was over, after the supper was finished, Jesus and the disciples, all except Judas, because remember Judas goes off to sell Jesus out to betray him, but the rest of the disciples go with Jesus, and they leave the upper room where they've had this meal, and they travel down into the Kidron Valley over to a place called Gethsemane. And I shared with you last week that the upper room, this is the city wall of Jerusalem, and the upper room would have been right in this area, the place where they gathered for the meal. And after the supper was over, it would have been sometime around 11 o'clock in the evening, Jesus would have gone with his disciples outside the city gate because they would have avoided the temple guards that would have been here. This is now the Dome of the Rock, but in Jesus' day, that would have been the Temple Mount. And there would have been lots of temple guards there, and so they would have wanted to avoid this gate and avoid this area. So they have gone out of the city wall here, traveled down into the Kidron Valley, over to, this is where Gethsemane was. And it was there in Gethsemane that Jesus prayed in anguish. He cried out to God. He said, God, if there's any other way that we can accomplish the salvation of the world, because he knew what was ahead. He knew the suffering that he was going to experience. And so he cried out to God, please let this cup of suffering pass from me. If there's any other way to do this, let's kick in plan B. Let's do it that way. But in the end, Jesus concluded his prayer by saying, but not my will, your will be done. He submitted to the will of the Father for the salvation of the world. So around the time he ended that prayer, sometime around midnight, the temple guards would have found out from Judas where Jesus was. In fact, Judas led them to Jesus over here in Gethsemane. They arrested Jesus. And if you remember, when they come to arrest Jesus, nobody knows what to do except Peter pulls out his sword. And he slices off the ear of the high priest's servant. Now, I've always wondered, why did he cut off his ear? Was he just that bad with a sword? I don't know. I mean, obviously, Peter's not Zorro. And maybe the force was not with him. But, you know, like you had lost an hour of sleep last night or something. That's supposed to be funny, y'all. So, Peter's not Zorro. Jesus rebukes him. He says, Peter, you put that sword away. You live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. This is not the way I roll. That's my translation. This is not the way I roll. And then Jesus willingly submits to the arrest. And he walks willingly with the temple guards from Gethsemane. All the way back, he retraces his steps essentially back up the hill. And he ends up very close to where he started, at the high priest Caiaphas' house. And there, in the dungeon of Caiaphas' house, Jesus would have been detained, awaiting his trial by the Sanhedrin. And that's where we pick up this morning in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14. I'll begin reading at verse 53. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes were assembled. Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards, warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many gave false testimony against him, and their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.'" But even on this point, their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer? What is this they testify against you?" But he was silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "Why do we still need witnesses? You've heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" All of them condemned him as deserving death. Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." The guards also took him over and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You also were with Jesus, the man from Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you're talking about." And he went out into the forecourt. Then the cock crowed. And the servant girl, on seeing him, began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again he denied it. Then after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly you're one of them, for you're a Galilean." But he began to curse and swore an oath, "I do not know this man you're talking about." At that moment, the cock crowed for the second time. Then Peter remembered that Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me 3 times. And he broke down and wept. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So this is how I'd like for you to help me this morning. I'd like for you to turn to a couple people around you, and I'd like for you to deliver this message. The message is cock-a-doodle-doo. Can you do that for me? Cock-a-doodle-doo. I can't tell you how much pleasure it gave me to look out and see some of you Clemson fans out there say that to each other. It's a wonderful day. But cock-a-doodle-doo. There is a reason for it. So last week, I took you to the Garden of Gethsemane. And so today, I thought I would take us to the Church of St. Peter. Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. Now, I got a picture here of the Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. If you've never heard that word, Gallicantu, don't feel bad. I had never heard it before I traveled to Jerusalem either. But the word Gallicantu is a Latin word that means cock-a-doodle-doo or cock crow. So this is the Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu, and if you can barely see it, but up at the top there's this weather vane. Even above the cross there's a golden rooster. This church is built on top of what we believe was the high priest Caiaphas's house. That's the setting of the passage we just read. It's built on top, and you can go down underneath the sanctuary. There's several different lower levels, and one of them is a cistern, a place that, if this is in fact Caiaphas's house that this is built on top of, and you never can be completely certain about these things, but certainly Caiaphas's house would have been in this area of Jerusalem. And if this is Caiaphas's house, then this is the place in the dungeon where Jesus would have been detained. And this church stands here today as a memorial to that. Now, there have been several other churches that stood in this place. The first one was built in the 400s, and over the years, several different churches were built and destroyed on this place. And this one was built in 1931. You can tell it's a lot more modern, but it's built on top of what we believe was Caiaphas' house where Jesus would have been detained. This next picture was taken outside of just outside the church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. And I don't just show you this for the handsome guy on the right. I show you this to give you some perspective about where this is. So this is the Dome of the Rock. It's where the temple would have been in Jesus' day, the Temple Mount. So that's how close they would have been to the Temple Mount. The way off here in the distance, probably a little over a mile away, would have been the Garden of Gethsemane. This was the Kidron Valley that now has houses and stuff in it. And then part of it is also a big cemetery that I've shown you before. But in Jesus' day, this would have just been a dark valley. And all of outline here is the Mount of Olives. So I show you that to give you some geographical perspective of how close these things were. So Jesus first was in the upper room of the house where they had the Last Supper, traveled down through the Kidron Valley to Gethsemane, prayed there, then the guards show up and they haul him back to this place where Caiaphas' home was, and there he stands trial. So it was after midnight in the Garden of Gethsemane when the temple guards show up. And they arrest Jesus, they haul him off to Caiaphas' house, and when they get there, there's a lot of activity going on at Caiaphas' house. Even though it's the middle of the night, there's lots of buzz, because Mark tells us that all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law were gathered. In other words, this is a gathering of the Sanhedrin. It's the Jewish ruling body, similar to like our Supreme Court. And so they're all gathered. They don't usually meet at night. And not only do they not usually meet at night, but they never meet on holidays. And this, remember, is Passover night. This is the beginning of Passover celebration. So they never meet because it was forbidden in the Old Testament for the Sanhedrin to gather on a holiday. But they do it anyway. They do it because they are desperate to get rid of Jesus. They want to be rid of Jesus. They want to silence him because they are afraid. They're afraid of the crowds that Jesus has gathered. He's become popular. Just a few days before, on Palm Sunday, he gathered with a crowd and he rode this donkey triumphantly into Jerusalem, and they all were waving palm branches and proclaiming him king, and that made the religious authorities nervous. They don't like it. They don't like the fact that Jesus is gaining popularity. He's taking attention away from them, and they're supposed to be the religious authorities, and that makes them angry. And not only that, but they also don't like the fact that he's having an economic impact. Because just a couple of days before the Last Supper, Jesus went into the temple and he saw the money changers. You remember this story? The money changers were there changing money. Remember, this is Passover, and hundreds of thousands of pilgrims would have been streaming into Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. And one of the things they needed to do was to pay a temple tax. But you could only pay a temple tax with the Jewish shekel. You couldn't use your dollars, you couldn't use your pesos or your euros or your yen. You couldn't use it. They wouldn't take it. They wouldn't have had those. They'd have had Roman money. But they couldn't use Roman money either, so they would go to the money changers in the temple to exchange their money for shekels. And the money changers, we know, were charging exorbitant fees to change the money. And Jesus goes into the temple and sees this going on, and he is livid. He starts turning over the tables of the money changers and running them out. The religious authorities don't like that. That has an impact on their pocketbook. And so most people think that that's really what sealed the deal for Jesus, that he ran the money changers out. And from that moment forward, they were dead set to get Jesus. They wanted to do away with him. So they do. They pay Judas off. The temple guards go and arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they haul him before the Sanhedrin at Caiaphas' house. Now, I've often wondered why they even bothered having a trial. Because there is no justice in this trial. It's a kangaroo court. The decision's already been made. The verdict is already in, and they haven't even heard the evidence yet. They know that they're going to pronounce Jesus guilty of whatever charges they can trump up. And that's exactly what they do. They have this trial, and Jesus is found guilty. And now they're trying to figure out a way to get the Romans to enact the sentence, the death sentence. So that's the trial. It all happens really quickly in the middle of the night, so nobody else knows what's going on. It's railroad job. And that's Jesus' trial. You probably noticed that the sermon title today was Trials and Denials. So the second half of our passage moves from the trial of Jesus into these denials. And as we shift gears to the denial, let me just say that I think Peter gets a bum rap. Because we remember Peter mostly for his failures, right? That's the thing we remember most about Peter. We remember for his failures, like the time they were out on the Sea of Galilee and they were in the boat and the big storm comes up and Jesus tells them to get out of the boat and walk on the water, and he does it, but he takes his focus off of Jesus and quickly he sinks and Jesus has to grab him and say, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" And we remember that failure. We also remember another time where Peter takes Jesus aside and tries to rebuke him for what Jesus has been teaching the disciples. And Jesus has to say to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're setting your mind on things of the world. Get behind me, Satan. We remember that failure of Peter. And then we remember Peter probably most of all for this failure that happens on this night of Jesus' life, where he denies that he even knows Jesus, not once, not twice, but three times. He denies that he knows Jesus. I'd just like to point out one thing in defense of Peter. At least he's there. Where are the rest of the disciples? They have scattered. They're gone. They're nowhere to be found. At least Peter is there. Peter was there. He's the one who pulled out his sword and tried to defend Jesus. And only Peter followed Jesus and the soldiers to Caiaphas' house. At least he's there. Now, Mark does note that Peter follows Jesus at a distance. Did you notice that? In the passage we just read, if we can get the next slide up there, Peter follows Jesus at a distance. He's afraid to get too close because he knows if he's associated too closely with Jesus that they might want to arrest him. And he doesn't want to be arrested. He certainly doesn't want to die. So Peter follows, but he follows at a distance. He keeps some space between him and Jesus. It made me ponder this question. I wonder if sometimes I am guilty of following Jesus, but following Jesus at a distance. I wonder if because there are times when life gets tough and there are times where there's pressure from the outside. And I wonder, when the heat is on, do I sometimes try to act like a secret agent of Jesus and follow at some distance? Because getting close to Jesus can be dangerous, right? I mean, he's going to ask us to take up our cross too, and that can get scary. What about you? Are you following Jesus at a distance? Or are there times when there's some space? Are there times when it would just be easier and you fall into the temptation of keeping this whole Jesus thing quiet? I don't know. I think there are for me. Well, Peter makes it to Caiaphas' house and all the way into the courtyard, and there's a crowd there. And it's early spring in Jerusalem, so it is chilly. Jerusalem's at a pretty high elevation, and it's chilly this time of year. The people in the courtyard are all huddled around the fire. And it's interesting because all four of the Gospels tell us about this fire. All four of them tell us that the denials, Peter's denial of Jesus, happens as he's huddled up around this fire. This servant girl comes out and she sees Peter and she says, "Hey, I think you're one of those Jesus followers, right?" And I imagine Peter's stomach drops. He's been following Jesus at a distance for a reason. He doesn't want to die. And so in his fear, he denies this claim from this servant girl. "I have no clue what you're talking about, woman. I have no idea." But she's persistent. She pushes Peter. She says, "No, I'm pretty sure you're one of them. You were with him. I'm pretty sure you're one of them. And again, Peter says, I don't even know that guy. And then some other people pile in and they say, no, wait a minute. You talk funny. You have an accent. You kind of talk like Jesus. We're pretty sure you're one of them. And Peter gets angry and he says, look, I told you I don't even know this guy. And then you could hear it. Cock-a-doodle-doo. The cock crow. In that moment, Peter heard the cock-a-doodle-doo. Do you know what that moment feels like? You know what moment I'm talking about, right? That moment when you're found out. That moment when you're caught. There's no hiding. You have to face the music. You know you've disappointed somebody. You know that you've had some huge lapse of judgment. You failed so badly that you just wish you could hop in a time machine and go back in time. Do you know that moment? That's how Peter felt when he heard the cock-a-doodle-doo. As soon as he heard it, he broke down and wept because he remembered that Jesus predicted that moment. If you know what that feels like, that moment of being caught, that moment of failure, if you know what that feels like, I think there's hope for us this morning in this story. Because all four Gospels tell us this fact about Peter's denials happening around the fire. And Peter's there, he's warming himself by the fire, and all four Gospels tell us that it must be an important detail that he's warming himself by the fire. But only one of the Gospels tells us what kind of fire. Only John tells us that this is a charcoal fire. Now, normally that wouldn't be that significant, except that the word charcoal fire in Greek is a very rare word to be used in the New Testament. It's only found twice in the entire New Testament. The most common word for fire is a word pour. It's where we get our word pyro. It's the same root. We pyrotechnics or pyromaniac. Or that's the most common Greek word for fire. But that's not the word that John uses. John uses a different word. He uses a Greek word, anthrakia. Anthrakia, it means charcoal fire. The only other place besides this episode where Peter denies Jesus, not once, not twice, but three times, the only other time that word anthrakia is used in the entire New Testament is also in the Gospel of John, later on after the resurrection when Jesus appears to his disciples. They've been out fishing all night long and you remember they didn't catch anything, but he tells them to cast their nets on the other side and they haul in this massive load of fish. And Jesus is on the beach next to an anthrakia, a charcoal fire. He's making breakfast. And Peter and the disciples come ashore and they stroll up next to the fire by Jesus. And there by that anthrakia, Jesus asked Peter, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, yeah, Lord, I love you. You know I love you. No. Peter, do you love me? Well, yeah, Jesus, I love you. No, Peter, do you really love me? Jesus, you know I love you. Not once, not twice, but three times. Do you see what's happening there? In this moment, on the beach, next to the anthrakia, that's a signal to the only other use of that word in the entire New Testament, we can signal back. There by that fire, Jesus is giving Peter an opportunity to affirm his love for him the same number of times Peter denied him. In other words, Jesus is giving him a chance at redemption. Gives him a chance to redeem him. He still loves Peter. And he wants Peter to have the chance to affirm his love for him. Despite Peter's failures, despite Peter's biggest failure, which is denying Jesus three times, despite all of that, Jesus still loves and extends grace to Peter. It just goes to show you that Jesus' love is bigger than our biggest failures. Are you with me? I'm going to say that again. Jesus' love is bigger than our biggest failures. Amen? Jesus' love is bigger than our biggest failures. No matter what we do, no matter how many times we make mistakes, no matter what our biggest failure is, Jesus' love is bigger than our biggest failure. Have you ever wondered how we know about Peter's denials? Because remember, the rest of the disciples, they scatter. The only one left that we know about is by name is Peter. We got this servant girl, and there's some crowd of people there. The only one we know is Peter in that courtyard by that fire. So who tells on Peter? Who's the one who starts spreading this word about his biggest failure, his three denials? Who's the one who tells that story? The only person who could have told that story is Peter. He tells it on himself. Because it becomes a part of his testimony. Maybe from that point forward, after the beach where Jesus gives him a chance to redeem himself, maybe from that point forward, he starts preaching about this and sharing that story. He says, hey, you think you've messed up? Huh, you ain't got nothing on me. I denied that I even knew Jesus three times. And so if you think you messed up, know that I messed up even bigger. And you know what Jesus did when I messed up? He loved me anyway. He loved me anyway. He redeemed me. He even told me that he was going to use me to spread the news of his love to the entire world. Jesus' love is bigger than our biggest failure. That's what Jesus does with our biggest failures. He redeems them. Thanks be to God for that. Amen. That's where we'll pick up next week, exactly where we left off in the Gospel of Mark for the final day. Amen.